for the sermon, Mr. Buchanan.
How many of you, my technician will take care of it, how many of you remember your first Feast of Tabernacles? Everybody does. Mine was 1972 in Minehead, England. How about others? This is a little bit of a different setup for the sermon today, but I'll leave this stuff up here. But I wanted to do it this way in order to let you take a look at some original materials that are part of the Church of God treasure for many years. My first feast was in 1972, Minehead, England, and I remember prior to that time, Mr. Armstrong had come to visit. He usually made a habit of visiting all of the freshman classes, and we had, how many did we have in our class? We had 250 total students, so I think we had about 60 or 65 in the freshman class that year in 1972, and Mr. Armstrong would come for the initial dance, held late in the summer, and then he would have a special meeting in which he would meet all of the freshman students, and he usually would combine that with Bible studies and Sabbath services and all of that. And that was very close to when we would, I can't remember when the feast was that year, if it was late September, early October, but I do remember him covering in a Bible study, going through a history of the feast and how he and Loma Armstrong first began keeping the feast. And then I realized as an 18-year-old that was about to keep my first feast, and I had been attending church for almost a year up until that time, I realized that Mr. Armstrong had been keeping the feast up to about 45 years before I ever met him. And he mentions that in his autobiography and other writings, and it's very inspiring. We always remember the first feast that we kept, and it's a real treasure. And on behalf of just everything that I'm a part of, and I'm not going to thank you on behalf of God and Jesus Christ or anything like that. I don't have that authority. But I hope it comes through very, very clear in the message today that you have had a part in keeping this alive. Yes, every single person here that has ever kept the feast has had a part in keeping the Feast of Tabernacles alive. And I believe that I can at least submit to you. I don't think I can prove it dogmatically, but I think I can submit to you that up until the time of Herbert Armstrong, the feast may not have, let's see how I'm qualifying this already, the feast may not have been kept for 1900 years or so since the time of the early New Testament church. And so I think, you know, there's some evidence that points to that. Dogmatically, can we say it? No, we can't really say it at all. But you may not be able to discover, I would say maybe the burden of proof could be switched around. You may not be able to discover any documentation that shows that even the people of God kept the holy days prior to the time of Herbert Armstrong. So, or I could phrase it another way, there is perhaps a gap that would be difficult to disprove of 1900 years from the time of the apostles and maybe some of their disciples up until the time of around 1927 when Mr. Armstrong first began to keep the Sabbath. You know the story. Mr. Armstrong was challenged on the issue of the Sabbath day by his wife. And a neighbor was a Sabbath keeper. A neighbor was a member of the Church of God Seventh Day, as we remember. And going back and thinking about it, it's all very inspiring to know that he challenged her and said, I know it's got to say you have to keep Sunday in the Bible because, and I'm paraphrasing, all of these churches can't be wrong. And so he had been a very successful businessman and a salesman for a number of years. But as you know the story, he had had some business reverses, had a meager income, had some jobs that he was doing, and yet he had a lot of time on his hands because he had had these business reverses. And so he studied day and night to prove his wife wrong. And I think it was after 6 months, was it about 6 months or so, he found out that, lo and behold, she was right. And he was convinced on the issue of the Sabbath. And he had to then, since he was convinced on it and had been so ardently proclaiming that there was no such thing, that it would change or whatever it was that he said, then he was convicted in his own mind by the study and obviously led by God. to then start keeping the day. And so they started fellowshipping with the Church of God Seventh Day, a small group of people of what we would normally term the Sardis era. And so for some folks, that's kind of a pejorative term. But I believe it. I believe it's in Revelation chapter 2 and 3. I believe that they are not only general areas and locations on a globe in Sardis or in Turkey somewhere, but I do believe that they do represent successive eras of the Church of God. And, you know, whether you can prove that to anybody's satisfaction is really not the point. It's not necessarily an essential item of salvation, is it? But if you'll turn to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 19 through 21, I want to impress upon each person that is here the vital element and the vital role that you play as a member of God's church. Because Paul shows that the entire church of God at that time, both the Jews and the Gentiles, were built on a foundation. The whole authority of Scripture, or you might just say this entire Bible, built on the entire authority of this Bible, and the church itself is part of that foundation. Now, even at the time of Peter, in his writings, you'll read in Peter that he had understood that Paul writes some things that are somewhat difficult. I'm paraphrasing now. You can look up the scripture. Paul writes some things that are difficult to understand as the other scriptures. So already Paul's writings were being accepted by another apostle as being a part of the inspired writings of God. And so in this inspired writing, he says, "Now therefore you are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets," those that actually put pen to paper or put pen to the scroll or whatever, the jots and the tittles, the ones who are responsible for that God-breathed, God-infused message. They were putting it down on whatever they were putting it down on in the Old and the New Testament. And it says, "And are built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together grows unto a holy temple in the Lord." In keeping the holy days of God, you should then be able to prove, using this as the basis, that the feasts of God are indeed valuable and necessary for a Christian's understanding. Because, and you should be able to prove it from the Bible. You should be able to go directly to the Bible and prove not only that those feasts that I've spoken of earlier are necessary and valuable, but they are a part of the entire body of Jesus Christ, a part of the house of God. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15. A significant question could be considered here. Paul wrote to this young minister, Timothy, "If I'm delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God." Conduct yourself. How you'll walk. What will you do as a Christian? What are the practices that you will observe as an individual member of the household of God? Paul's writing so that Timothy would know how you conduct yourself in the house of God. He doesn't talk about the feast, obviously, at this point, but he says, "which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." In maybe it's not right to belabor the point too much, but I take a certain amount of pride in the people of God in 1995, and sometimes a few earlier than that, although the issue came to a crisis regarding the Sabbath and the holy days only in 1995, there are other problems earlier on regarding what had happened in Pasadena, but there was a culmination. And the crisis came to a head at that particular time where there was a repudiation of that which we took. I have nothing against, there's no need to have warring factions among God's people. Other people left earlier, that was good for them. We accept them as brothers and sisters in Christ. Anybody that keeps these days, the Sabbath, keeps them holy, we accept them as brothers and sisters wherever they are, no matter the organization. Is that enough of a qualification? There are other people that do these things. We all have the same roots to a certain extent, and those roots are traced back to Herbert Armstrong and Loma Armstrong. But the church itself is the pillar and ground of the truth. I would put it this way. Everyone sitting here is an individual that stood up for the truth. Everyone that is here and is a part of the congregation of God now supported the truth of the living God and was a protector and zealous protector of the faith. You might say a modern day, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, that's it, but that's too specific. Modern-day crusader, yes, thank you. Modern-day crusader, zealously standing up for the truth. So the church is going to be found supporting the truth. If you want to know where God's people are, they're supporting the truth of God. Now then, you might ask, who and what is the church? And we'll answer that a little bit later. But let's turn to the book of Leviticus chapter 33, because this is the chapter and one of them that Herbert Armstrong, along with his studies about the Sabbath, was challenged on this issue as well, and he began to read about these annual Sabbaths. I had never heard of annual Sabbaths. I didn't know anything about them. I've told you how ignorant I was about the Bible when I was a kid growing up in a Lutheran church, but I had no conscience problem, no realization of what these annual Sabbaths were until I began to come in and study with God's people. But Leviticus 23, verses 35 through 41, on the first day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. These are the feasts of the Lord. Seven times that phrase is mentioned in this chapter. Which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations to offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. A burnt offering and a meat offering, a sacrifice, and drink offerings. We're shown in the book of Hebrews that many of these were replaced by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, because that's in fact what they pointed to. No time to really prove that here. You can study it on your own if you don't believe it, but that's what we teach. That's what we understand. Beside the Sabbaths of the Lord, and beside your gifts, and beside all your vows, and beside all your free will offerings, which you shall give unto the Lord, you shall keep it a feast unto the Lord 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. And that really hit Herbert Armstrong very hard. Forever means forever. It doesn't mean that they were nailed to the cross. Doesn't mean that the law is done away. Of course, the law was not done away, as we know. I think even in the Kingdom of God seminars, at least in El Paso, we went through Matthew 5 and talked about how the law was magnified, not done away. It has a spiritual intent in other ways. And then we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 23 and verse 26, and you can see, again, the commandment is there, and this was covered very well by Mr. Bishoner in his last sermonette, talking about the utilization of second tithe, which, by the way, we'll show today is something that Mr. Armstrong began to understand around 1945. We have proof about that. And I'm also going to give you, I think, a very helpful, I'm going to share with you. Usually, you like to, as a speaker, you like to keep all your sources secret, you know, but there's no secrets anymore because the internet is so widespread. But I'm going to tell you right where you can go onto the internet, because some people have done some very fine work in preserving all of this information. I'll give you that website, Verily. You can Google it. You can find out where it is, and it's got a wealth of information. My only caveat to that is, don't just fall in love with it, because it's got every old booklet, it's got every old article, every old Bible study correspondence course, and some of that material is great. Of course, if you're going to start keeping Pentecost again on Monday, you're kind of missing the point of looking up some of that information, but I'll give that to you in a little bit. Deuteronomy chapter 14 and verse 23, you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place which he shall choose to place his name. The tithe of the corn, of the wine, and of your oil, and the firstlings of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. That is one of the major purposes that we will take with us as we leave and go to the Feast of Tabernacles. That's one of the primary reasons that God gives us the holy days, so that we can learn to fear him better, or respect him and to love him better, because we have a greater understanding of his law and his days and what they picture for us. So you shall bestow that money for whatsoever your soul desires, for oxen, for sheep, for wine, for strong drink, or for whatsoever your soul desires. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. And so these are feast days. Mr. LaRavia can appreciate this because as we started going to more and more communities, we had to find better language. We started calling it the festival rather than the feast to people that didn't know our practices, because one person that I think came up with this, not associated with the United Church of God any longer, but said, you know, I think quite accurately that when you mention feast to people, they're thinking of chicken bones over the shoulders and, you know, sitting at a medieval table or something and, you know, squash, drinking mead or something. And but we're told that there's a reason that these feasts are commanded, and that reason is to help us develop a right relationship with God. They help us to understand our relationship with God, with our fellow man. They help us to understand the law of God. We learn to love God first and then to love our fellow man. So it's fulfilling both aspects of the Ten Commandments. Some are directed towards man, the rest are directed towards God, as we know. And all of this was originally given to a nation through Moses. And Deuteronomy 34 and verse 10 shows that there's been no greater prophet arisen in Israel except for Moses. So we know it's very, very valid. But Mr. Armstrong started keeping the Sabbath after being challenged in 1927. And he told us when we were freshmen that it was just he and his wife that kept those days, these holy days, for 7 years, up until the time of 1933, in which the small group of people that they were associating with at that particular time also began to keep the feast. I've got with me, and I'll, if you want to look at it later, inspect any of the stuff that I have, I'll have it here after services, but I've got the attendance figures for the feast from the time of 1933 at every feast site in the United States anyway, all the way up until 1985, when this particular printout was given to me by a good friend who was one of the business managers that I worked with for a number of years, George McFarland. You'll probably remember the McFarlands. The best business manager, I think, in the history of feast keeping. Just we got along so well. It was just a delight to work with him. The understanding of the essential truth concerning the meaning of the holy days wasn't yet known, but there was a time in which the understanding of the holy days did begin to resonate with Mr. Armstrong. Now, later on in life, and I've got an article that shows this, in 1981 in the Pastor's Report, or Pastor General's Report, he writes that it was for a longer period of time. It was like 12, I'll quote it later in the message, 12 or 14 years that he and his wife kept the days without really understanding the message. But that was writing many, many, many more years after the fact. But if you examine the first of these letters that I've reproduced for you, you can see that there is a glimpse of understanding about that. And this is from a, you can take a look at it, this is from the Bulletin of the Churches of God in Oregon in 1935. The address, 564th Avenue, West Eugene, Oregon. So he's writing here to the members and to everybody that had written in, and he talks about the Church of God in the first century, as you can read. Oh, pardon me. I'll step out of the way. Thank you, Paul. As you can see, you don't have to see the entire thing, but you can find this letter, which I've accurately reproduced because it was on a PDF file, and I had to copy it and paste it thank you. Yeah, there's a little adjustment there. Let me help you with that. Here, there's a right here. Does that do it? Okay, thank you. So Mr. Armstrong talked about in the bulletin to the churches about the annual Sabbath. So this was 1935. And he talks about the Sabbath. The second paragraph talks about the annual Sabbath days commanded to be kept forever. And then he doesn't talk about the understanding, so maybe we'll go to another letter here in just a bit. But the last paragraph shows the conviction that rang out through him. The fact that some haven't seen this before doesn't remove the obligation once we find out that it should be kept. So that same zealous attitude that he had in keeping the Sabbath when he began to understand the holy days, even around the same time in 1927. He just kept them, he and his wife, because the brethren that they were associating with did not readily accept it. And so there isn't any record of attendance at the feast until 1933. And that's when the group of people began to keep them together as a group. So later on, Mr. Armstrong would begin to understand exactly why it was that we would keep these. Okay, that's what I want to come back to in a little bit. So later on, Mr. Armstrong understood the meaning, but the main thing is that, you know, we are the inheritors of all of that understanding, and we know all of that now. I mean, I came in, it was kind of ready-made. You know, the ground had been plowed for a long time, 45 years before I came onto the scene. And I would say, since that time, virtually very little in terms of the understanding of why we keep the feast has been added. In fact, I can't think of anything. Can the other elders or anybody else long time? I can't think of anything except for some minor changes since I came along. And then it was for a long time, you know, even going back to the 40s and the 50s, that many people came upon the understanding of the holy days. Not only that, but they understood what they meant. So outside of the small group of people that had been called to affiliate or associate with Herbert Armstrong, no one accepted it. None of the people, I don't know about Mrs. Rubicorn, who was the next door neighbor who brought the information of the Sabbath. Maybe she came along, but the people that they were associating with in the Church of God Seventh Day did not accept this information. And so where was the responsibility on Herbert Armstrong's part? Well, he preached the gospel, and he even had to take that information to the Church of God Seventh Day. And this is the you know, a very accurate reproduction of the original minutes of that meeting in May of 1937. Yeah. So first paragraph in May in Detroit, Michigan, talks about the Church of God Seventh Day and how they allowed Mr. Armstrong to read about the holy days. And he also presented, I think in that same conference, information on the identity of the tribes of Israel or the people of Israel, the identity of the tribes, 12 tribes. They rejected that as well. But the first paragraph talks about reading of the Pentecost, Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles, followed by discussion. Then all the way up to 3 days later, they went ahead and read the rest of the article that Herbert Armstrong, and then they discussed it. And this was their conclusion after, and these were ministers of the Church of God Seventh Day. And we trace that historical antecedence of the Church of God Seventh Day back to the Seventh-day Baptists of New England. And we trace their historical antecedence back to the Seventh-day Baptists in England. And then back across the continent of Europe for hundreds of years of people that were Seventh-day Sabbath keepers that we believe, or at least our research indicates, that they were the true church. Stephen Mumford, Rhode Island, you know the story. At this time in the 20th century in 1937, Herbert Armstrong brought the information that he had studied and he had practiced now for almost 10 years by his wife, with his wife alone, and then for 4 years now with a small group in Eugene, Oregon. And I'll give you those. Actually, I can get those attendance figures now because you're probably thinking, okay, how many? That's right, there it is. How many people? We don't usually give sermons like this, so forgive me if I'm a little bit scattered. Okay, in 1933, the attendance was 21. And then in successive years, it goes up to 24, 27, 30. And in 1937, just after he presented this information, there were 34 people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. As far as we know, those were the only 34 people on the planet keeping the Feast of Tabernacles as God's people, because this information was rejected by the entire conference. And they rejected the information that we have just covered a few of the scriptures on the basis of Acts 15, which most Bible students at a rudimentary level know that the Holy Days weren't an issue that was even considered by the Jerusalem conference. Wasn't even an issue. You know what the issues were. The main issue was circumcision. This isn't, you know, pardon me, has nothing to do with circumcision, the Holy Days. But let them say, spare thy people, O Lord. Spare them from keeping the annual Holy Days. And so it was rejected. And so from that point on, the affiliation was very, very loose after that point. Mr. Armstrong details it in his autobiography. But there had been this 34 people that had begun keeping the feast. And so those are the people that they began to associate with. So it's kind of almost a reverse issue of what we faced in 1995, but a similar in some ways if you think about it, because we found that the group that we are associating began to reject those days which we all accepted and felt very dear to, and individuals did not feel as strongly as we felt about it. Mr. Armstrong left the Church of God Seventh-day Fellowship and continued on his own. And we did the same thing. So, in a sense, history kind of repeats itself from time to time, does it not? So that was the decision that was made at that particular time. Herbert Armstrong went forward with this information. And interestingly enough, as they continued to do it, as you'll see, this is from The Good News, which was a letter, and this is... This one is not dated, but I can tell you what the year is. This year was 1945. This was a letter that went out to the members in 1945, and on that date of the Feast of Tabernacles, that particular time, they had at Belknap Springs exactly 60 people. They had 40 people. The year before, in 1944, near the end of World War II, or after at least the war in Europe had concluded, they had 60 people. And then they suffered one of the greatest drops in attendance at the feast that the church had experienced at that particular point, a 33.3% drop in attendance. Interestingly, we kind of know why, too, and I'll tell you about it in just a little bit. But this is Belknap Springs. Mr. Lance Christensen was down in Sierra Vista when I spoke this morning. And since he's from Oregon, and so we can see that it has close proximity to Eugene and as well Salem, and it's right in his backyard. I asked him if he'd ever gone to Belknap Springs. It's up in the mountains, mountain resort, and he said no. I said, wow, you'd think that somebody that was a zealous church member would want to see where the first feast was, wouldn't you? Just shrugged his shoulders. I told him I wouldn't repeat the story in afternoon services, but I couldn't help it. So, sorry. Sorry, Lance. You can tell him later. But we kid a little bit every so often. So he's talking about the... time in which they felt that this was going to be the best feast that they had ever had, because the reason was because they were now separating away from Eugene. They were keeping the feast at a secluded location, so that it was just the church all by themselves up in the mountains, and it must have been very beautiful. 1945. They had running water then, didn't they? They were camping. That's for sure. Or they had cabins and stuff. So wouldn't work today. Well, wouldn't work in our house. Terry's not here, so I can say that roughing it and camping for her now is like the lowest she'll go down to is a Holiday Inn now. So maybe, I don't know, she wouldn't even go to a Motel 6. But in 1939, we find, and I don't know if I've bypassed this one. Let's see. This is also, I must have hit this. I bypassed this, so I am sorry for doing so. This is 1939, writing to the church. For over a year, we have looked forward to the Festival of Tabernacles, our camp meeting time, the Bible time for camp meeting. Of course, the reference there is to the evangelistic activity that had taken place because, and it was not an uncommon thing even in the 30s and the 40s, obviously, for them to have evangelistic meetings. And they were used by preachers of all sorts and different types. You've seen they've made movies about it, but they would have these in the summertime traditionally when it was when the weather was good. And, you know, as the fall came on, people didn't like to go to camp meeting because it was getting colder and you're in an open-air tent or, you know, not too much covering the tent. And Mr. Armstrong had to convince them that, you know, people like to go to camp meetings, but this is the Bible time for doing it at the Feast of Tabernacles. And at this particular time, World War II was just beginning. So you can see that some of the understanding and the knowledge of what the feast means is coming through. If there is ever a time when we need to come together at this meeting, it's now. The war has started in Europe. Probably the last world war to be ended by the return of Christ. If so, the time of great tribulation is now right upon us. Another thing we find is that there was virtually nobody talking about Bible prophecy and preaching, and Herbert Armstrong was certainly the first. In fact, Billy Graham congratulated him on a kind of a forced phone call between the department store owner of Harrods in England, and Herbert Armstrong was in England at the time, and he kind of arranged this telephonic conversation between the two of them, and Billy Graham certainly congratulated Brother Armstrong on his gift of preaching of prophecy. Now, in the last paragraph, it says, of this time when the final world war has started, following the drought and invasion of grasshoppers, bugs, and insects, God solemnly warns us through Joel, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather into the house of the Lord your God, and cry unto the Lord, blow the trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, let the priests, the ministers of the Lord, weep before the porch and the altar, and let them say, spare your people, O Lord. So obviously, some of the meaning and the understanding of why we were doing this was present there in 1939. Mr. Armstrong related that it was probably later on years, he wrote, as I mentioned in the pastor's report, that it was, you know, even many years after that, but it was apparently right around that time, 37, 38, 39, that there was an association between doing something and why we do it. And that is something that we are all recipients of at this particular time. And then the next slide that I've already gone to is the one from 1945. Now, I mentioned 1945. I mentioned the attendance dropping from 60 in 1944 to 45 in 1945. Is there anybody that has any idea as to why that precipitous drop, which had never happened before and didn't happen for many years after that time, any students of church history that would like to hazard a guess? And I'm not trying to pick a question just because I know the answer to it, but but it's a theory, and I marked it off in my notes long ago. And if I'm leaving part of the story out. It was in 1945 that Mr. Armstrong took a look at Deuteronomy and found that there was an additional tithe to be kept, and that's how we get to keep the feast. Second tithe began at that particular time. And obviously, this was something that was going to be refused by some people. That's my theory. I'm not blaming those 15 people for not keeping their second tithe, but it is an interesting idea. And because when you take a look, you can come up and examine this afterwards. You can take a... Oh, rats. I didn't mean to do that. You can come and take a look at this, and you'll see at the attendance list... Stupid computer... Possibly one of the reasons that the church wants to buy me a new power book. Oh, they don't? Okay. All right. Because in this attendance list, it calculates the percentage change. And just notice this, every year, from the first year to the second year, 14%, and then I'll just read them quickly, 12% gains, 11%, 13%, 11%, 10%, 9%, 4%, 8%, 7%, 7%, and then a drop of 33 1/3% from 1944 to 1945. But then it took off again, 25%, and these are huge percentages from year to year. 30%, 15%, 20%, 22%, 36%. In 1952, I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, that's the year of my birth, there was a 200% increase. I didn't attend the feast that year. There was a 200% increase in attendance. And one of the reasons was, I suppose, is that they opened up that year Siegler Springs, which is northeast of California. And then it just continues rocketing up, 66%, 40%, 42%, 40%, 31%, 46%, 36%, 27%, 40%, 32%. And it just goes on and on, 31, 27, 26, 21, 21, 16, 16, 14, all the way up until 1972, a 7% increase. That is my first feast. 7% increase, 10% increase in 1973. And then we started realizing some slight, you know, it kind of leveled out at about that particular time. But some of you have undoubtedly fallen into that category of people who have begun keeping the Feast of Tabernacles through those years. And in 1948, Mr. Armstrong, we don't have enough shelves around here, Mr. Armstrong started, this is an article that was written, I put the title Second Tithe on this one, but this is the article that Mr. Armstrong wrote, How We Can Afford It. It was a part of a coworker letter in 1945. And in 1948, notice that Mr. Armstrong certainly knew the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles at that time. Notice the second paragraph. Unfortunately, a few of you have not been going the past 2 or 3 years. Do emphasis mine here. Do you plan to go to the Feast of Tabernacles after Jesus returns? I can just hear him thundering it out, can't you? Of course, we know that there will be both ordinary mortal humans, just as we have today, and also the saints, then changed to immortality in bodies of spiritual flesh. Yeah, maybe some slight terminology changes through the years, spiritual flesh. But of those mortals not yet saved, including all heathen and Gentiles, it is written that every one of them shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the feast of Tabernacles. Now, all of these letters you can find on a website called Friends of the Sabbath. I've got many of the original ones, as you'll be able to see by the age and the coloring of them and the marking of them. I've got, well, some of, they're not original ones, but they're photocopies of original ones, and I've just kept them in my file for many years. But it's amazing that there's, you know, with a few slight alterations, at least since that time, we know that the Church of God has been always keeping these days. And that's where you come in. That's what you have all been doing. Maybe none of you since 1948. I don't think any of you have been keeping the feast since 1948. Some of you maybe a few years after that particular time. And then Mr. Armstrong quoted in this same letter, I didn't have space on it for the slide, but Zechariah 14 verses 16 through 19, in which he shows that if any don't go up, they're not going to get any rain. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 29 through 33, God said to Moses, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Go say to them, get you into your tents again. But as for you, stand here by me, and I will speak unto you all the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which you shall teach them." What are the holy days of God? They are statutes. They are fully law. They were taught to Israel. They were kept by the people of God in ancient times in a certain way. And you know what happens? Joshua 18 and verse 1. When they kept the feast, the people were happy. When they kept the feast. Now, the Bible doesn't say that they were keeping the feast at this particular time, but it certainly appears as though they were. And you can read it in Joshua 18 and verse 1. It says, "Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them." We know what happens when Christ returns. The land is going to be subdued. This was a type. This was a parallel of what will happen after Christ returns. And so the land was subdued. People were happy. It was a land flowing with milk and honey. And they enjoyed a rest. We know that, as Hebrews 4 says, that it was only a physical rest. Hebrews 4 verses 8 says, "If Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God." This is a beautiful part of Scripture that ties in not only the Sabbath, but the meaning of the weekly Sabbath, the annual Sabbaths, and what they portray for all of mankind. Now we know, I'm just going to cite some scriptures. I'm timing myself, so I don't want to... I'm 37 minutes. I'm going to cite 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 32 and 33. I'll cite that. It's easy for you to look up and to read. It talks about what Jeroboam did after the kingdom was divided. He instituted a feast in the eighth month, not the seventh month, so that these Israelites wouldn't be going down to Judah to keep the feast. They had an alternate feast, and we know what happened. They went into captivity as a result of not keeping the feast. Israel went into captivity. It doesn't really matter whether if they knew what the ultimate purpose of it was. It was just by doing kept them in a habit of obedience and kept their minds on God and not on themselves. The more they got away from God, the more likely they were to go into captivity, which they did. 721, 718 BC, Israel went into captivity. Same thing happened to Judah, as we know. They eventually went into captivity because they neglected these days. They neglected the Sabbath, and they were punished because of it. The Jews were so zealous in coming back. Those that had been carried away into Babylonian captivity in 585, the last deportation, that the survivors and the remnant of those people realized, because it had been impressed upon them by prophets sent to them, that this is what happens when you disobey God. So, if anything else, I hope this helps us all to remember you are a part of this, and you cannot neglect this for any reason, because bad things happen when you neglect the holy days of God, if you know about it. And if you realize it, now it's possible there's somebody sitting here that it's not really making an impression that I don't believe it. I doubt that. I'm just saying it's possible because somebody asked me in Sierra Vista, "I've been in the church for a long time, Mr. Buchanan, and I don't understand if these people went to the feast with us, how could they ever leave that?" I said, "Well, okay, where do I begin?" You should know the answer to that question. I mean, really. 1 Kings chapter 13, verses 33 and 34, Jeroboam was warned. He did not change his evil ways, and that kingdom went into captivity. Now, the Jews were so zealous when they came back that not only did they keep the Sabbath and sanctify it and keep it holy, but they did keep all of the annual holy days of God. And we find that in Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 17. Says, "The whole company that had returned from exile built booths and lived in them. From the days of Joshua the son of Nun," which we've already read, and I said in Joshua 18, you may not be able to guarantee to somebody that that was the Feast of Tabernacles because it doesn't say that, but it says they assembled at Shiloh, it says they had the tabernacle of meeting, and it says they rejoiced. I mean, I don't know how it could be even more clear than that, or words to that effect. But this says that Joshua and the son of Nun and Israelites did celebrate it. It infers that they kept the Feast of Tabernacles because they had not kept it and celebrated it like this. And their joy was very great. day after day, from the first day to the last, Ezra read from the book of the law of God. They celebrated the feast for 7 days, and on the eighth day, in accordance with the regulation, there was an assembly. They did it according to the statute, according to the law of God, and it made them happy. It made everybody happy, the whole nation. Now, it didn't last, but it was to these descendants that Christ came some 400 years later. Christ kept the Feast of Tabernacles. We know as a 12-year-old, his parents were keeping the feast, and he was so caught up in the activities that they had to go back to the temple and find him. And he was learning of the things, as he told his parents, of his father. And he didn't just keep the feast because it was traditional. You can take a look at John 7, and it's a very interesting read. It really is, because John 7 shows that Christ went up to keep the feast in 30 AD at the threat of his life, because they wanted to kill him. The Jews sought to kill him at that particular time. He didn't go up with his brothers. He didn't bring notice, but he came up to the feast and kept the feast and later appeared in the temple to teach. And he knew that people would probably not try to kill him right in front of all the people, and so it was safe. He practiced good judgment in that sense. So he taught. People were there to draw their own conclusions. Verses 37 and 39 of John is very interesting. This has been a controversial point with some people, and I say, poppycock, why are you getting all concerned about this? And I'm not going to even quote the answer that we give on this, because I think it's immaterial. I think it's such a twig and such a silly thing to get hung up on. John 7 and verse 37 says, on the last day, that great day of the feast. So there's a raging controversy. Was it the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles, or was it the last great day? That has been a controversial issue, has it not? I mean, Mr. Tannert, Mr. LaRavia, hasn't it been somewhat of discussion? I mean, okay, I can understand discussing it, and okay, it'd be nice to nail it down. I really don't know what the answer is. But I think it's immaterial, because he gives the meaning of the day. He talks about God's plan and what's going to happen. He points everybody to what John would later write about as rivers of living water, meaning salvation for everybody that wants it. On the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood, cried out, saying, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. But this he spoke concerning the Spirit, whom those believing in him would receive, for the Holy Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. People were convinced. Some people said, in the next verse it says, some people said, this man is a prophet. So that was during a time in which his life was threatened. So why should we keep the feasts of God? Well, obviously, to retain that understanding. As members of the Church of God, it is your responsibility. It's something you can't get away from. You have a God-given responsibility to keep that flame going. It's not something that you can say, well, it doesn't apply to me. You've got to do it. 1 John 2, verses 3 through 6 shows that we have to follow the example of Jesus Christ. Whoever claims to live in him must walk as Jesus walked. Your conduct has to be just like that. Now, in Acts chapter 18, Acts chapter 18 and verses 19 through 20, it says that Paul came to Ephesus and left them there, but he himself entered into the synagogue, and he reasoned with the Jews. And when they wanted him to wait longer with them, he consented not, but bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that comes to Jerusalem, but I'll return unto you if God wills. And he sailed from Ephesus. So he had a long boat ride down to Jerusalem. And then, you know, overland, I don't know exactly how far it is. I would guess it's probably, by looking at the map, probably 60, 70 miles from the coast to Jerusalem. Probably not an easy travel, several days from the coast to Jerusalem in those days. But did they know the things that you know? And I submit to you that they did. Because in the book of Acts in chapter 2, it says in verses 17 through 21, Peter goes through the entire gamut of the holy days, and then this very inspirational quotation says, in the last days, God says, I will pour out my spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams, pointing to the time that Christ spoke of in John 7, because it talks about a time in which salvation will be offered to the point to where people are going to have an understanding of what that immediate future in the great white throne judgment holds. There is going to be an understanding of God's plan during that time, the great white throne judgment. It's going to be made manifest to everybody that's living during that time and is resurrected in that resurrection. Even on my servants, both men and women, I'll pour out my spirit in those days and they will prophesy. And then he shifts gears a little bit, talks about the day of the Lord. I will show wonders in the heaven above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and glorious day of the Lord. And everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So quoting Joel, Peter spoke with assurance regarding the plan of God, and the understanding of the plan of God was there. How come it didn't last for up until this time? Because when I was a kid, there was nobody else talking about the plan of God or the holy days of God. Now you can go into a Bible bookstore and you can find some books about the Feast of Tabernacles, and they have some truth to them too. We may not have the entire corner on all of that, but I bet person per person, we have more people who are associated with the people of God actually knowledgeable about what these days mean and what they portray, and that there's a reason here that we're doing all of this. And even on the Sabbath day, what we are doing is very, very meaningful. Now, Romans 8 and verse 14, about the church. As many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. The church is made up of those who are led by the Spirit of God. End of story. Organizations come and go. The walls, the barriers, they're up. Men erect those things. It's unfortunate. We can't always get along, but anywhere people are actually keeping these days with their intent or striving to, we know that they are led by God's Holy Spirit, and by definition, they are a part of those who are solidifying the truth. They're guarding the truth. They're zealous for the truth. They're an undergirding to the truth. They're a pillar of the truth, and they're a foundation. That's what we have been called. That's why you are here. Every single person that is here today is in the church for that purpose. That is what you have been called to be a part of. It's not your only purpose, obviously, but that's why you're here. So, in ancient times, we can see that the people of God, the nation of Israel, kept the feast with imperfect understanding. We still know that they kept it, though, and that they were blessed for it, and they were happy as a result of it. Anytime you're keeping the law of God, you're going to be happy. We know that that rarely happened in the nation of Israel, and because of that, they went into captivity. Later on, we find the early New Testament church doing exactly what you're doing today in keeping the feast. But after that, maybe after the disciples of the apostles had died, that information, that knowledge was gone, I submit, until it was awakened in the 20th century. I have no real proof of that. I don't know if there's any real, but until there's real proof that I'm wrong, then that's going to be at least my mindset. If somebody says that, I'll be overjoyed. If there's something in history that shows that people actually did this for any time period of any of the eras of God's church, that would be exciting to find out. I don't think it's been found. But the exciting thing is that you are now the undergirding of this information. It's up to you. It really is. That's your part, at least a part of it, in the plan of God.